Hi, I'm Ambika Gautampai. I'm a writer, I'm a mom of two little babies, and the sort of person who just cannot stop thinking. You are listening to Corner Office Breakdowns, a podcast that reconciles humanity and the workplace. Here we dive into conversations that usually happen in whispered tones or behind closed doors and bring them to the center, contemplating and breaking down the way leading and living have historically been done and rebuilding them together. Corner Office Breakdown sits at the intersection of business and leadership, equity and emotion, parenthood, womanhood, personhood, and as crazy as it sounds, the meaning of life. All of the guests you will hear from are people who have fundamentally changed my outlook. They may shift yours too. Thank you so much for being here. I hope you like this podcast. I hope you love it. I hope you share it. And I hope you subscribe. Silence. It is one of my absolute favorite things to just hear and sit in silence. And it's not frequently silent in life, in most of our lives. And to cherish silence and to be able to experience it can be such a gift in a world that is unpredictable all around us. So I personally and lately have a really beautiful relationship with silence. But there's a lot of sides to the concept of silence. When silence is used against us versus as a tool for us, that silence is very different. Choosing to be in silence, whether that is silent in thought, in meditation, in peace, or being silenced, where silence is thrust upon you regardless of whether you want it or not, are very different things. My relationship with silence wasn't always a good one. I spent a long, long time in my life and in my career being silenced. And most of the time, I did not know it at the time. It's only now, looking back in retrospect, I recognize all of these little and big things happen that left me feeling like my voice wasn't worthy of being heard, my opinion didn't matter, if I spoke, I'd be getting myself into trouble. And nowadays, it's weaponized the other way too. Speak, be vocal, or you are not an ally. You are not with us. Silence is far more nuanced than that. And that is why I was so intrigued by Elaine Herring's book, Unlearning Silence. And I was at a moment where I kind of needed a break from books about business and leadership and, you know, other things that sometimes feel like work, even if you love to learn about them. And this book delivered such a beautiful mixture of deeply personal learning and also learnings that I think would make many, many, many of us better leaders, myself included. And the art of listening, how to speak out, and how to know when it is okay to respect and be in reverence of your own silence because it's intentional. But Elaine expresses all of this in far more understandable words. Her book is a fulfilling and fast read, surprisingly, or maybe I just ate it up because it felt so relevant. But it's truly a stunning book, and I'm so excited to share this conversation with you and for you all to get to know Elaine. Hi, Elaine.
Hi, how are you?
Well, we just had a previous catch up, so you know how I today is a day, and we're giggling because it's just the chaos of like the human experience and being alive. But in all seriousness, it's a very heavy time in the world. And that is just functioning as, I think, a backdrop to how we're, not all, but many of us are navigating our lives and decisions and emotional landscapes right now.
Totally.
So we have, Elaine and I have just come from a catch up on all of those topics and are now going to peel back the curtain and just talk about it again.
How can we be human together?
How can we be human, and how can we, when should we sit in like a reverential silence and just allow ourselves the space to be? When should we be very vocal and use mm-hmm. our voice? And when should we help others find or tap into or just simply unleash their voice? And you touch on that and much, much more in your book called Unlearning Silence, How to Speak Your Mind, Unleash Talent, and Live More Fully, which I told you in my email earlier, it's like dog-eared and annotated, and there were so many pieces of it that hit me right where it hurts, but also probably hit me right where I need to be hit in order to grow, as we all want to do for ourselves on this journey.
I know. And I'm also like, did I at least hold you?
Oh,
did I hold you through the process? Because that was part, I was like, I'm not punching people just to punch.
No. I mean, okay. Give me very tangible things to think about. You gave me like facts and statistics that made me feel like I wasn't alone. And I think navigating silence is such a fascinating thing, again, against the backdrop of this world and silence being complicity and mm-hmm. people demanding others use their voice when mm-hmm. maybe their voice is not their tool of express. There's so much nuance in the conversation of silence.
Mm-hmm.
And your book follows such a beautiful arc from like our own conditioning mm-hmm. when it comes to our voices, but then also how we could be silencing others completely unknowingly, and how, as you know, leaders or managers or parents, anyone who has a level of influence over somebody else, how conscious we need to become of silencing.
And I love the way you put that, because anyone who has influence over someone else, that actually is all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Even if we fundamentally underestimate the influence that we have, or mm-hmm. our influence does not seem as great or as broad mm-hmm. as someone else's influence.
Mm-hmm. You say in the book something like, the most powerful people don't know how much power they have. Or something. I'm probably not.
Power is invisible to those who have it.
Yes, power is invisible to those who have it. And it's true. I think a lot of people don't think of themselves as leaders or people mm-hmm. with influence or sway. And yet, as you just said, it is all of us in many different ways. So Can we start, Elaine, with just you sharing your relationship with silence and what made that the center of gravity for this amazing body of work?
Yeah, people say you write the book that you needed when you were younger. I say I wrote the book that I still need today, which is also why it's called Unlearning, ING, silence rather than unlearn silence, or like I've checked the box, I'm done. I am the youngest daughter of an immigrant family from Taiwan to the United States. And I share that because as the youngest daughter of a family from that culture, I'm supposed to be quiet. I'm supposed to be diminutive. I'm supposed to be sweet and respectful. And respectful means ask, not asking any questions, not having a perspective of my own, doing everything to take care of everyone else and expecting nothing in return. Oh, wait, this sounds a lot like motherhood.
I'm like, and my experience as the eldest daughter of an immigrant family.
Oh, great. It doesn't get better with being earlier. I mean, same thing, right? What are the expectations that we have, particularly of girls or women or femme-presenting people? And that to me was a lot of children should be seen and not heard. Don't speak until you're spoken to, which serves you pretty well in school because you're a good student. Good student, not because you're creative or have critical thinking, but because you're obedient and you're not disruptive, which is also rewarded in entry-level positions in the workplace. But then you're told that you're a great entry-level hire, and this maps the statistics. Have no executive presence, you're not a value add, any of these things. You're a good doer, but you're not a leader.
Oh, the times in life we have all heard these statements verbatim.
And then you are told you need to speak up more. But when you speak up, you're too loud, you're too aggressive, you're too emotional. You smile too much, you smile too little. You can't get it right because it's someone else's goalpost. And that to me was a real examination of the advice we've all been fed and the way that the problem statement has been positioned. Meaning, the problem is you need to speak up more. So therefore, you need to have more courage or more confidence. Essentially, just do it or and go fix yourself. Versus, why is it hard for me to speak up? Oh, because there's this social expectation of how I would show up. And if I don't show up within what Adam Galinsky, social researcher, says is the acceptable range of behavior, I'm penalized for it. I'm actually not making it up in my head. It is that I have both learned this, internalized it, it's become unconscious habit, and the people around me continue to silence me. Not because they mean to, but because their priorities and preferences, opinions suck all the energy out of the room. Where is there room for me, what I care about, what I need? And by the way, my job description is essentially make everyone else's lives easier.
Oh my goodness. No pressure.
No pressure. And it feeds into, by the way, how I was raised. So to me, if we can at least ask the right question, we have a much better chance at solving it in a meaningful way.
How did you
Meaning,
stumble? Oh, no, you go.
what's the role of silence on our team?
And how did you stumble on? I mean, once you sit with the title of your book, it hits you how much of the way our systems and society are built are predicated on who is the silencer and who is being silenced. What was the moment in your life or career where you had the aha of this is the tool that has been used against me, and this is what has been my own struggle and my own wound that is holding me back?
Yeah,
Do you remember a moment?
George Floyd. I was standing in our side yard. I was breastfeeding my son. My father was going through chemo. I was not on the streets protesting. And I felt like a horrible human being because silence is violence, right? And using your voice translates to being on the streets protesting. And I did not feel like I was not willing to risk my child's health, my father's compromised immune system because COVID was a thing,
COVID, yeah.
to protest in that way,
Yeah.
which really begs the question of when everyone says use your voice, why is there such a narrow perspective of what voice looks like? And if you're not fitting into that mold, then you're not a good human being or you're not using your voice versus, and this is Omkari Williams' work of microactivism, different small actions that make a big impact over time. And I realized, well, I was taught not to protest
Yeah.
as a child. The Cultural Revolution meant that if you spoke out, there were real consequences, as there are real consequences right now for using your voice in any way, taking any stance. And so, in what ways have I learned silence? In what ways do the people around me actually incentivize me to
Yes.
stay silent, which I would say is silencing me, reward me for staying silent, right? If I do what my colleagues at the time prefer, then things are fine.
Yeah.
If I push back or have a different way, there's friction and tension, and I'm the problem, is how it's presented. By the way, our policies and our practices either support or silence different groups of people, and we're not intellectually honest about the impact of the backdrop that we're all against. We say, like, pull yourself up from the bootstraps. You can do it. If you work hard enough versus no, there's exclusionary practices, and we're not talking about those because we want to pretend that everyone's equally situated. So can we name that and have that conversation rather than saying, go fix yourself? Because even fixing myself, A, I don't know what that really means. B, doesn't solve the problem. C, doesn't change the world around us.
Have you heard, Elaine, one of the things that crept up in my mind as I was reading was the concept of pet to threat? Yes. Okay. You've heard it. And I'm assuming a lot of people have heard it, but I could not stop thinking about that precarious line that so many of us have experienced in our careers, where, and just to describe it a little bit, you come in. Oftentimes, it is a phrase that refers to a person of color entering a company. And for people like Elaine and I, we are the stereotypical hard workers, don't make much of a fuss, like, keep your head down, work hard, money will come, sort of people. And we come in and people think, oh my God, so smart, such a good worker, like, so happy to have her on my team. She can handle anything we throw her way. And then there comes a moment where, I would classify in my mind the pet phase as her compliance or silence was her greatest asset, which you wrote at some point in your book. And that's the pet stage, right? You're like learning, you're being quiet, you're respecting your superior or your elder in a familial scenario. And then all of a sudden you say something that's controversial, exposes a gap, calls somebody out, or just simply expresses your point of view. And all of a sudden you're a threat to the system, to the way of working, to the way of thinking, to the way of coexisting as a familial unit, however you want to slice and dice it. But I have experienced that transition so tangibly in so many moments of my career. And then that phase of my career just kind of ends. Because thank goodness, perhaps I have more self-worth than I give myself credit for. And I'm like, yeah, no, this isn't working for me.
Oh, good for you. So you walk versus forced out.
I walk, but it's always after something very dramatic and being told things about myself and my form of expression and my voice that isn't considered appropriate to the others who are predominantly, not multiracial and not women or mothers.
That I love that you have enough self-worth and willingness to say, no, I'm not going to put up with it. And also their loss, right? Of all of your talent and insight. Because the phase I was stuck in for a long time was the I want to change it from the inside because I am the only one. And if I am no longer here, then no one else sees it. No one else is saying anything. Things don't change for anyone else. And came to a point of it is not a personal failure if you cannot single-handedly change the system. And I and my health and well-being matter also. I took a very deep breath when you said pet to threat. Because that experience is real. It is the meta narrative of this book getting out into the world. It's not public.
Woo. What was that?
That is not public. Because there are these things called NDAs that many of us sign. I was a really good team player.
Myself included.
I was a really good team player. I made everyone else's life easier. I built other people's brands. I know you have too. And then I refused to perpetuate inequity and let that double standard be held against me. And so we're going to talk about it in closed, behind closed doors. So we all know. Because it serves none of us to think that it's only us.
Exactly. And ironically, that's where the title Corner Office Breakdowns came from. Even if we can't talk about it in the cafeteria of the office, come into my office and let's break this shit down.
I also love, I mean, my interpretation, this is why I think the title is genius, because there's also what is breaking down in terms of systems of power when we think the corner office gets us that, or that it's safe, or that that's what we aspire to. And let's break that down, because I made it to the corner office. I was managing frickin' partner.
And
But that doesn't mean.
we don't even have to say it.
I know.
I mean, and I think the most what this is almost like a side note, but it just has to be said. Like, also the amount of like devastation and grief and loss of pouring yourself into your career to have it taken away because you had the audacity to stand up for yourself is infuriating.
Completely. And I will say, if being in relationship, whether that is keeping the job or staying in a friendship or partnership, is predicated on silencing yourself. Is that really a relationship you want to be in? Which is why I think that is the beauty of you walking, right? When you're like, nope, not putting up with this anymore. That question has been ringing through my head because we also over-index on the fear of uncertainty, of not knowing what comes next, or is it going to be worse? Or we tell ourselves, well, here are the benefits, here are the good things. Paycheck's pretty nice. But for me, it was also there's this deep sense of betrayal. Something that had been sold to me of this is a forever home, Partnership means we have each other's backs. And I always suspected that that wasn't true.
So sad.
Right? And then your intuition, talk about intuition. And then when you test it and you realize, yeah, it actually just meant that I've always had your back and you enjoy the narrative of we've have each other's backs. But if you know all this about what I'm carrying and you still choose to kick me to the curb, it shows me your true colors, and then I can decide what to do about it and what I care about most. And I will say, being a solopreneur now has been the best thing that has ever happened. I don't disagree with the outcome of my leaving. I disagree with how it went down. It didn't have to go that way.
So I want to just go back for 1 second to you believed you were somebody who could change things from the inside. Because I'm like, I
Been
hold
there?
belief. I still hold this belief. And 50% of the time I'm like, you're delusional, Ambika. Like truly, something is gonna change. And the other half of the time, I have this narrative in my head, which is a little bit Elaine, what we were talking about before the call of how are we going to fully change systems and structures if the people who sit on top of those m massive monolithic systems and structures all look and act and think the same? And so to me, and you know, this is something I've heard many leaders say. We have exceptional people. Ooh, but the narrative is that they're opting out. So let me come back to that. Leaving the workforce and pursuing more solopreneurship, entrepreneurship opportunities. And what that's perpetuating then is the people in power at these extremely powerful places and organizations are never challenged, maybe. And the narrative to your, to, yeah, the narrative is that the individual is opting out. Like, do you think I want to opt out? Do you think I don't want my paycheck or my health insurance, especially when I have a child, children? Oh, so yeah, I've been thinking about that so much, and it was one of the main drivers when I took this role in like quote unquote corporate America, as I was like, I do believe power can be changed from the inside out, and I don't know, like I this is also me wondering, like, is that me just being naive?
I don't think it's being naive. I do think there is a test case, right? People often ask, how long do you give a place? How do you know? And for organizations that actually are doing the work, actually have target, is there demonstrable progress with certain metrics over time of increased representation in changes in policies, in transparency of what's happening? So you can plot where are we on this journey, and are we actually, does the action back up what's being said? The service companies and leaders can also do to all of us to just save time and energy is be intellectually and verbally honest about what you're building. If you're not looking to build something inclusive, stop saying that. If you are trying to be the most efficient company ever, then say that and people self-sort. But it means that we stop spending time beating on doors or drums that go unheard. And that energy, it's just actually a more efficient outcome. Let's be intellectually honest about what we're building and not building, and people can opt in rather than the trap of thinking we're walking into something, figuring it out later, being confused, being gaslit, and then being like, wait, what just happened? And then the transaction costs. We all know the transaction costs of hiring someone for the individual and for the company. So let's channel those resources differently. I will say that I do think you can change it from the inside. It's just slow and takes a lot of energy. Before and after I left the firm, I did get paid family leave through, which
Right.
was not something that I experienced when I gave birth. And that feels like progress for the people who have since taken family leave, right? That is real
Yes.
impact. That is not to be discounted, even if it didn't completely transform the organization into the one I would have wanted to see. And so I also have Claudine Gay and others, former provost of Harvard, in mind of that choice of whether you're doing your work from inside an organization or external. That to me is a deeply personal one that only you can make,
Yeah.
and that there's no judgment based on what you choose, so long as it's your agency to choose. Because frankly, we need people working from all directions.
I agree.
And also, I don't know what else you're carrying. I don't know how much health insurance matters to your family right now, which, if you have a spouse who carries it different, all these things, no
All
one else knows, and only you can choose. The thing I would encourage us all to keep an eye on also is, are we able to stay sufficiently whole as
Yes.
human beings, day in, day out, in that role?
Is
And
anyone able to? And this is an
yeah.
honest question because,
Yeah.
we are both very much in the thick of it in our own ways. And I don't know one single other person who feels complete in anything they're doing. And I know that's not what you mean, like some, idealistic scenario. But I think there are pieces of us being broken off that we've chosen, like parenthood, even though it doesn't need to be that big of a hunk. Yeah, there are pieces of us that are being broken off at every turn. The minute
Totally.
you turn on the news, the minute you pick up your phone and see the next, Instagram post, of the horrors happening in the world, and then have to, like, wipe your tears and get on a conference call to try to figure out a business problem. And it's just so interesting. I feel like that too, even with solopreneurship, right? It's almost less about the immediate micro environment being the depleting factor and more about the macro environment being the depleting factor.
I'm sifting through that, sort of listening to micro and macro, because the micro to me is so, I'm on the phone with the principal at my kid's school. That's micro. That's really front
Yeah, front and
right
center.
now. And the context switching between work and that. Paid work in that. I mean, I think where I get to is that's why to me the phrase is sufficiently whole. It's not whole.
Yes,
It's
true.
sufficiently whole to be able to live with ourselves, to live another day. Right? We've all been in jobs that are completely soul crushing, soul sucking. Someone that I talked with this morning was like, I was walking to work thinking, I hope I get hit by a bus today because I really don't want to go to that meeting. And it was like, oh, that is an alarm bell. Right? That to me, you've crossed a line of what is not working. You are not sufficiently whole. You are not, you cannot live with yourself. You do not want to live. That is problematic. Versus, am I annoyed by my colleague? Yeah. Is it fine? Or is it good enough? Is there enough good in this that keeps me here, or enough that makes it worth it?
Yes, exactly. What was so interesting, I think what is so interesting about the work context in particular, goes back to the dominant and subordinate identities that you talk about in your book. And on the surface level, absolutely. There's the dominant identity of like the white male executive. There's the subordinate identity of the South Asian female executive mom, right? Of course. I also think what's so interesting about that is there are dominant and subordinate elements of our own identities. Like I can go into a room with all male executives and play the part. But that is not keeping myself sufficiently whole. I think what I started feeling in multiple work environments is like I could see myself like succeeding with heavy air quotes, but I could feel my sense of self getting more and more and more diluted. And that then became my subordinate self versus my dominant self and identity. And that to me was that's when the turning point happens for me, is when I'm like, wait, who is this Ambika? Like, this isn't me.
I love your awareness, though. How long does it take for you to notice that? Because I would argue that many of us spend years, decades, particularly when climbing the ladder, because it's just told you this is what you have to do. You have to work as if you're not a parent and parent as if you don't work. And by the way, there's only one model for people who have made it to that level of leadership. So you better, right, best practice is to do this. But best practice, where does best practice come from? Who's drawing those conclusions?
Yes. It's so interesting. So, Jessica Gross, who's an opinion writer for the New York Times and just one of my favorite, talks about, and it's rooted in another woman's thinking. So I'm not going to be able to perfectly cite it here, but Jessica Gross, in a lot of her content, talks about the concept of the ideal worker, and it's exactly what you said, Elaine. Like, work as if you don't have a family, parent as if you don't have a job. And I think that really plays into this dominant and subordinate identity piece because at work, we have been told time and time again, like you walk into work, dress for the job you want, lean in at the table, don't use your normal tenor of voice, like make your voice lower. Just all of these so like completely arbitrary, but masculine leaning behaviors that are supposed to be indicators of leadership.
Yeah, it's actually not arbitrary.
Okay, tell
It's
me.
a act like a white male, except we're not.
Except we're not.
And the call to action to me is how do we create leadership teams that have a broader definition of effective leadership? It's
Yes.
not to say that leadership teams today are particularly effective.
I would.
They've just been normalized.
They've just been normalized. And I think what's devastating, though, is even when you see a diverse, multifaceted leadership team, you never know if the people who are around that table have gotten there through just performing like they're everybody else. And what I found through my experience working with women and men who really did think themselves to be very like deeply compassionate, loving, feeling, woke, heavy air quotes again, human beings. Everyone just got to the top by copycatting on one another and consensus culture and saying the thing that is most palatable and most agreeable and the thing that fits that dominant identity. And even, you talk about the Babel hypothesis of leadership, which literally made me laugh out loud, even though it's not a funny concept, but
Because you
it's
know so many people.
so true. And it was one of my biggest insecurities coming up in my career. is I was like, oh God, I'm one of the thinkers. Like I can't
Yes.
respond fast enough, and then I can't get a word in edgewise, which I know you felt as well.
Yeah, so let's define Babel hypothesis of leadership
Yes.
for folks listening, which is human beings tend to code frequency of verbal contribution as an indication of leadership or leadership potential. Quantity, irrespective of quality of contribution. So hence the Babel hypothesis of leadership. You could just babble on and people think that you are a leader, you are a leader because you're talking more. And to me, that's part of guarding against our narrow definition of leadership. Just because someone's quick on their feet or verbally inclined doesn't actually, do we want the best ideas or we just want the loudest ideas? Do we want good thinking or do we want fast thinking?
In the advertising world, there's a little framework that we joke about, which is like good, fast, cheap. You cannot have all three. You can't have a good idea
Totally.
that we could turn around in 2 weeks. But that is what we currently define as success. Like, do you do a decent job? Can you do it really quickly? And can it drive the business? Right? Because nobody wants to sit for 5 years and watch you slowly grow something to success. They want to see it now.
They do, and I want to suggest. I'm not suggesting we sit and navel gaze. I'm saying give people 20 minutes to think.
God. Yeah.
And what a difference it might make that if, for people who are post-processors, meaning you process best after the conversation, we pause the conversation, say, here's where we're leaning in terms of decision making. As people post-process, reply all on the email. If nothing comes through, then we'll go this direction. But can we design the way we work that we don't exclude an entire swath of people who process differently from a wiring perspective.
Exactly.
And that also means that we don't have to clean up the mess later because we discover the issue earlier.
Yeah. And one of the things that that leads me to is talking about the different types of power and leadership that you articulate in the book. And I was, this is from 1959, which was shocking to me because I feel like I read a lot and consume a lot of content around this. And for some reason, I had just never encountered this, which is by John French and Bertram Raven, The Five Bases of Power. I'll read them off, but I would love for you to just sort of help us navigate through. And then I wonder if there is another one. It's there.
Yes, I'm sure.
Who the fuck is this lady? Like we know what we're doing here. That is
Be
more.
someone who has insights that French and Raven didn't.
Yeah, they didn't have these in nine. There were no women of color running companies in 1959. But the five bases of power, and then there was a sixth added about 6 years later, are one, legitimate, which is power based on hierarchy or an official role, like a prime minister has power, they are currently in office. Reward, the power to give or withhold rewards, like customers being able to write positive or negative reviews. Expert, power based on specific knowledge or skill. Subject matter experts, SMEs, making sure that, you have people who can talk the talk and present and get the deck together, but you have the experts in the room to inform. Referent, power based on how much people like and want to be like you, which is influencer culture. Coercive, power to penalize others, kids screaming bloody murder during long call rides or car rides. And then information, which is, power based on the information you have. Which feels extremely relevant to me at all times working at a large company because knowledge is currency. And the less people who know things, the more valuable that currency is. And this, in and of itself, really helped me dimensionalize the sort of leadership paradigms that exist. What is left out of those? And which one is the dominant, or which few are the dominant ones? that really do sort of reign over work culture. So what are your thoughts?
It's funny because I can go, it depends on the environment. Right? I think leaders make the mistake of thinking that just because they have legitimate power, meaning just because you hold the EVP title, that actually comes with power and comes with the assumption that people will follow you just because you're in the role. For some places it does, some places it doesn't. Military culture is very different than startup culture, for example, in terms of do I have to earn the trust? And many times we say expert power matters, but I actually, d your positioning, right, of people are brought in sort of as credentialing, but not actually given credence. I think it really depends. What do you see?
That's true. That's very true. Because at like a, you know, in the tech boom, it was the engineers that had all the power.
They had some power. I would say the founders, right? If they were well liked, well funded, had power. And it also gets me to, every executive assistant actually has tremendous power. You do not want to
Tremendous power.
cross them. That is both information power of what they know. And yeah, I think we underestimate the power we have. And would look at every team to say what power is traditionally rewarded here, right? What's the currency on this team? And what might be underutilized that could be helpful to me? People don't want to believe that referent power matters. It's like, I'm more objective than do you like me? But I mean, we've all been in the internal conversations where it's like, well, no, right? Like, I like Jim. Like, okay, but what about the criteria that HR spent hours, days creating for this job profile and criteria to make promotions objective versus you like the dude, so you want him in the role?
It's the classic, like, would I get a beer with this person interview?
Yes.
Ask when you leave an interview. They're like, oh, would you get a beer? And ooh, that question would bother the shit out of me because it was like, that just means, is this somebody I feel like I could be friends with who would reinforce my identity or play in the same identity space and not challenge? And referent power also is inherent for many people, right? Because it comes from the power of similarity and likability is similarity. Like, do you feel an attachment? And I see like referent power to me is, and this is like a little bit of a tangent, but this is the most fascinating to me. Like, Elaine, as somebody who went through the book writing and publishing process, and as someone who wrote a book on silence, you have such an interesting point of view because so much of the publishing industry right now is like, are you coming in with influence? Are you coming in with a platform? Like, are you proven that people like you? And again, likability is predicated on similarity and how palatable you are and how much you can draw consensus. And so, what is happening in spheres of power is we are continuing to prescribe the same people into power who have always been there with, what did you say? Oh, skin is not kin. With different skin potentially. Who have gotten to where they are by performing like Tom, Dick, and Harry.
Which is also to each of us, we might be termed rebels. But it takes me back to the question of how do we want to live? If you have one life to live, how do you want to live it? Do you want to live it performing?
Hell no.
Okay. Right. Like, this is is it worth it to me? Some people might get to a different conclusion, or I'm willing to perform until my kids are out of college.
Do I have to go and not be myself? Sometimes. But that isn't my day to day to day to day life. But you're so right. Like, what is the cost benefit analysis, which you also talk about, of silence, of using your voice, of performing? And one of the things you said, which made it so clear to me, is like, we often default to the cost of using our voice, like how we would be punished, how it's going to come bite us in the ass, and the benefits of silence, which are just like, it'll never come up, and then I won't have to deal with it
Or I
without.
don't have to deal with their defensiveness right away, because I
Exactly.
don't have time for that. I don't have
Yeah.
bandwidth for that right now.
Even if it's causing internal conflict within.
And that's the long tail, right? The overtime. Am I okay with that? I also want to be clear that unlearning silence does not mean saying everything to everyone all the time. The world is far too noisy and complex for that. And it doesn't, I mean, we all know no filter people, and we sort of wish that they would filter a little bit more. I do think there are different versions of ourselves, right? How I show up at pickup, school pickup, or how I show up on a podcast, or show up when I'm keynote speaking at a conference. Those are all different versions of myself that actually are all part of who I am. They're
Yeah.
different expressions and they're different context. You know, I talk in the book about I always thought that being a chameleon was my superpower because I could work across industry. You
Yeah.
can put me in front of, a tech startup and I can wear my jeans
Yeah.
and talk in that
Totally.
space. I can be in financial services or law firms and put on my suit and talk. And that to me is range. That's not disingenuous. That's a how do
Yeah.
I show up to meet people where I'm at in a way that is still okay for me? It doesn't feel not me, but it's a particular expression.
I think that is a beautiful distinction between performance and being inauthentic and range, which is just like tapping into different parts of who you are based on the environment you're in. Which is such an interesting, like, counter reference, not counter argument, because code switching is a very, very real thing. Very real thing. My family still makes fun of, we still all make fun of each other because somehow when we pick up the phone with each other, like the Indian accent starts to come in.
Love it.
And then when we pick up the phone to like a colleague in front of each other and we're like, why are you talking like that? Right? But I think the range point actually puts you back in a place of power. You
If
know?
you are choosing to be in all those spaces,
Yes.
and you may say, nope, that doesn't align with my values, or that is not where I want to spend my time and energy, but it's still from a place of agency to choose.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that to me is a really important nuance, because I think range might be one of the things that's missing from a lot of other more traditional types of leadership.
Oh,
Is
completely.
they're not, they are
Completely.
not aware.
Range in terms of ability to flex, range in terms of ability to imagine
Yes.
what leadership, that leadership could be quiet, that could be thoughtful, could be not testosterone filled or fueled, could be data driven rather than emotionally driven. I mean, it's so interesting that women and tears, women and emotions get a bad rap. Men have emotions too. They just manifest in different ways, and they're also more acceptable because it means you're passionate and you really care about something rather than, is it your time of the month?
Exactly.
And so, what is the interpretation of the behavior? And how do we all, I think it is each of us developing range. It is also each of us developing range in our perception of other people.
Yeah. Yeah. Very true. I have one, question that builds on this, but is especially timely. Just obviously it's a crazy moment in time in the world, and there has been an immense amount of just like loss and hatred and despair and grief. And one of the big conversations that seems to be taking place, especially on social media, is around silence and using one's voice in, favor of, opposition of, whatever, what you believe in. And a lot of people have been catching a lot of flack. Is it flack? Flack? For not using their platforms in that way, celebrities especially. But also, I think all of us to a certain extent. And, I feel like my immediate environment at work is very safe. Like, I called my boss yesterday after a meeting and I was like, I need your advice. Like, I don't know how to function right now. And I had mentioned to you earlier that it was my daughter's fourth birthday. And, these babies who are, who have lost their lives and are all over Instagram, like they look exactly like my children. And it's a really, oof, it's difficult. But I felt like I could go to my boss and say, do you have any advice? And it was beautiful to have that because I've never had like a big sister figure or anything, or someone I can go to and as a woman or a mother, as a woman of color, and just like feel held professionally and personally. Like, oh, I feel really grateful for that. But I'm also really scared sometimes to be open about it because I also work for a Fortune 100-ish company in a senior role. And simultaneously, I have this, like, I am veering more and more towards activism as I age. And so there's such a delicate line here between like silence and using your voice, and is silence permissible? And can silence be a mode of like sensitivity and self-care and self-reflection, or is silence just like you are complicit? And then on the flip side, with voice, sometimes using your voice gets you in trouble. Sometimes you're not tapping into the right, version of your voice or the articulation that has the intended impact on people, which is another bit from your book that I love, is like the intended impact or how people are impacted by your message is almost more important than the message itself and how it's delivered, which I think is a hugely missed conversation in leadership. But just from a space of somebody who really understands, being silent, but using your voice and standing up for yourself. And you do talk about things in your book like the epidemic of invisibility and how many cultures have just been co-opted by the stereotype that is projected out in the world on behalf of them. And so I don't even know how to phrase the question because I don't know what the question is because it's so complex to me right now. But how are you thinking about using your voice or utilizing silence right now?
It brings out all the complexity of the topic, and complexity and nuance doesn't mean inaction. It does bring clarity as to why we're doing what we're doing, what the metrics might be. So, chapter three of the book is when silence makes sense and self-care, self-preservation. Silence is strategic in that way. There's also a question of perceived silence. So, Amal Clooney is my favorite example because when you talk about celebrities being people criticizing them for not posting about what's happening in Palestine. Amal Clooney was really criticized. Like, do you not care? Your whole career is about this. And then She came out with an op-ed in the Financial Times alongside other human rights experts and activists saying, "We've been quietly, it wasn't visible to you all, doing this research, building our case for the ICC." And it was this, that to me is the clearest example of what people see from the outside or is visible on social media is not the be-all end-all of what is happening. Social media is a tool, an incredibly powerful tool that also means that the news that we're consuming is different, right? Many of us are watching people being killed, live streamed on Instagram, and people who are not on Instagram are reading things in mainstream news outlets. And we have fundamentally different data sets. And so we look at each other being like, how could this be happening and you not be moved to action? How could you not be affected? How can you go on as if business is usual? Because this is not usual. And is their world business as usual? Because it's a different data set. That analysis helped me understand a little bit how we could have such different reactions. And also Amal Clooney's example was a what people can see from the outside and criticize from the outside is not the whole picture. And is a question then of what do we each know? What are we each doing? And when we think about a life well lived, are we each living a life that we can live with? And what I mean by that is using your voice. What is using your voice? Voice is not just the words that you say in a meeting. Voice is how you move through the world. So our lives and our voice is fundamentally where we put time, energy, heart, and effort. So what are we each doing day to day that is in alignment with our values, with how we want to influence the world, that may or may not be visible to everyone? And it is. It can feel like we're dancing a line if you don't have a boss that you can call and have that sort of conversation. That is not the situation that everyone is in, which to me is how can we be that person for everyone? Right. That was the conversation we had before we decided whether or not to have this conversation today of is it actually going to be better to do something else? Because Trish Hersey would tell us rest is resistance. I
Oh,
would say that
that's
silence
good
is
here.
self-care, right? There are so many different versions and also what we need. And I mean, my hope is that if each of us is living with agency and with purpose and that not just being a good intention, but in action, it also means that we get to rest as well so that we do not burn out.
And I wrote a question to myself in my notebook when I was reading, and it was, what's the difference between practicing silence and practicing detachment? Because detachment is something I'm really trying to work on right now, because I can't function otherwise. I just can't. So I have to practice distancing myself a little bit from things. And that is as much like detaching from whether my children eat their healthy dinner, detaching from whether my husband decides to unpack the suitcase that's been sitting for a week, as much as it is detachment from exactly how a presentation goes at work. And then whether my best friend is being vocal about Palestine, right? And what came through your book very rapidly, like as soon as the question entered my mind, like the next page, you talked about agency, which is what you just brought up. And that to me is the crux of so much of this, is are you navigating your own life from a sense of empowerment and choicefulness? An agency and making decisions through that lens. And I think if you can stand there and, look yourself in the mirror and say, yes, I am, then that's all you can do.
Yeah. And keep showing up, Right, keep making choice after choice, which is also, hey, I didn't like the choice that I made before, or I didn't realize I had a choice. So many of us are like, we have no choice. We do. The choices may not be good or great or ones that we want, but we do get to choose how we spend our time,
Yeah.
how attached or detached we are from something, what meaning we make of it, what we choose to share publicly and not, how we choose to judge or interpret other people or not. And at the end of the day, we're the ones who have to live with ourselves.
Right.
And including that our actions impact other people.
Yes. And that's exactly what I want to conclude on is so much of what I believe to be my life's work is around just, again, reframing power, rethinking leadership, kind of dismantling that, yeah, like bureaucratic, hierarchical, white centered, male centered definition of leadership. And what I love most about the arc of your book is that it actually ends in a way that makes people aware of how they have been silencing others. And the example you gave, I want you to just reflect it back on the podcast because I think it made it so clear. And I feel everyone has those examples.
So if we're human, we end up silencing other people. Not because we're bad people, not because we mean to silence other people, but because we are human. So, one of the moments in my professional life that I regret most and weighs heavy on me is when a younger colleague offered some feedback on a job description. And she said, I don't understand how our firm is diverse and inclusive. And I did what maybe many people do, or maybe I just tell myself that many people do this. I felt the pressure to respond because being quick in response is often rewarded in fast-paced workplaces. So again, it's not the best idea, it's just the quickest idea or reply. And I wrote back saying, I can think of at least 10 ways that we are diverse and inclusive, which I want to tell myself is a pretty good response because I was engaging the topic. I can spin up a narrative, and I did at the time. I was engaging the topic. I also suggested we take it offline and talk about it on Tuesday at our morning meeting, whatever. I was channeling the sort of upbeat vibe that other leadership at the time had rewarded and built, and I was not yet thinking on my own. If I'm honest with myself, I was not yet thinking on my own. I was simply trying to channel what existing leadership had modeled because I thought my role as a leader was to lead in that way versus agency. How do I want to lead? What are my values? If I inhabit a role and have that legitimate power based on job title, how do I want to steward that influence rather than just perpetuate what I've seen done? And it actually doesn't matter what my reasoning was in the moment because the impact is what really matters. And the impact was her feeling shut down. Like I didn't hear the point that she was trying to make because asking the question at the time, I don't see how or how are we diverse and inclusive was actually a statement of we're not, and I should have probed more in the moment.
She clearly wasn't feeling that it was a diverse and inclusive environment.
Right. And I could, if I'm getting defensive, which we do as human beings, I could be like, well, she should have just said that instead of engage with mitigated speech and hint it or ask the question if you really have an opinion. But all of these things, we use low power language as also a survival strategy given power differentials.
Guilty as charged.
And then there's this question of, all right, If we've been in that moment where we did not show up as we hoped, what do we do about it? It took me a couple years actually, because we addressed the issue, we had a broader conversation, we did the tactical piece. I think this is the part that's not in the book. I went back to her about 3 years later and said, "I don't know if you remember that moment." Of course she did. Right? And I was like, I'm sorry. I shouldn't have done that." And she graciously accepted the apology, which is also a, just because we don't get it right the first time, what's next? Right? How do we choose to show up next? None of us are ever going to get it perfect or right all the time. But what's your next move? What's your next play? Because that also matters. And that to me is, yeah, we all, you know, one of the ways that we end up silencing people is that we assume they're like us and assume that if I'm not waiting to be invited to a conversation, why would I need to invite you to a conversation? If I talk things out best in real time, why would you be wired in a way that asynchronous communication actually makes it easiest for you? But if we stop and pause, if we're aware, we can actually choose a different way.
I could not recommend this book more highly, truly, as somebody who sees both sides. Like, I feel like I have been silenced many, many times and probably continue to be in ways that I'm not consciously aware of at the moment. And somebody who runs a team, or as a mother, or as a spouse, or a sibling, or a whatever. It also made me very aware of the ways that I may be not creating the space for others to use their voice. And I think that level of self-awareness and tools that can help people unlock that level of self-awareness are the tools that we need the most right now. And that is this book.
Thank you.
So thank you so much, Elaine. I couldn't endorse it more. And you will see that on my Amazon review. Everyone.
Thank
It's a treasure. And I
you.
hope that it sees the success it deserves.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Elaine.